where I do believe that the outcomes also depends on the person carrying out the test. Because depending on how you position the probe, you will have better or worse outcomes of your measurement. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Rhinoplasty Podcast, Season 3, where we're doing face-to-face interviews. And it's an absolute pleasure to come to you from Brussels, Belgium, at the European Rhinoplasty Course. And I have the director of the 15th course, the one and only, Peter Ellis. Peter, welcome.
Welcome. Nice to meet you again, Cameron. And welcome as co-director of the European Rhinoplasty Course, which is an honor, not only for the other co-directors, but also for all the attendees of the European Rhinoplasty Course.
Yeah, Peter, you know, it's, we're coming to the end of three incredible days. And, you know, I think that people listen to this podcast, or well, they should make an effort to come to this course. It's a unique course. And what does it feel like for you? 15 years. Did you think that you'd be running this course 15 years later?
Well, actually, at a certain time point in your career, you have some ambitions. And I felt there was a gap in education in rhinoplasty in Europe, especially education for ENTs, maxillofacial surgeons, as well as plastic surgeons, coming together, joining forces, getting inspired by each other. That's what it's all about. We have also Dario Bertossi as maxillofacial surgeon and co-director of the course. And I think this is very inspiring to learn from each other, to also not consider the nose in isolation, but look wider than just the nasal anatomy and just look wider than just the organ of the nose.
No, but Peter, that's something I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, in many of the courses, I think we're focusing a lot on surgical techniques, which obviously we have to have that, we've got to understand it. But certain areas, I think, perhaps we don't have as much a focus on. For example, I think the mental health aspect of surgeons themselves. The other one is the psychological aspect of patients. Now, you know, I've been working with some other guys about a rhinoplasty rejection study, etc. But the third area that I think is really a neglected area is nasal health and physiology and function, and things such as rhinosinusitis or allergic rhinitis and stuff. And I know that apart from your rhinoplasty practice, you are super involved with Euphoria. I mean, you're world lead on that type of thing. So I'm really interested to know what some of your thoughts are on those three things. So like the surgeon's mental health, psychological aspect of the patients, and nasal health. I mean, that's a big, those are three long questions. You can talk for a long time.
These are three big questions. And actually we have a session in half an hour about the ethical considerations in relation to rhinoplasty.
Okay.
And that session covers all these aspects that are actually neglected by most of our colleagues.
Yes.
Because we tend to talk about techniques, but we tend to neglect the patient behind the nose. We tend to neglect the patient expectations. We should not neglect mucosal disease. We should not neglect the impact of aesthetic surgery on the function of the nose. And what you're raising here as topics for a discussion are very close to my heart.
Yes.
Because we do see many patients being operated upon that actually should be better counseled or better educated about what rhinoplasty is all about. Two-thirds of my patients nowadays are revision cases. And actually, most of the risk for revision is not only aesthetically related to the aesthetics,
it's
also related to functional problems of the rhinoplasty, not having been properly informed about the aims and the outcomes and the post-operative care. So your question is very relevant. So coming back then to your first question about taking care of rhinoplasty surgeons, and actually there we must try not to overstress ourselves, not to overbook patients, take our time also in the OR. I personally never plan more than two or three complicated cases a day. Sometimes I have four a day, in occasional situations, five a day, but this is really the limit. I cannot take more, because you need to be prepared to handle complications or unforeseen bleedings or unforeseen lack of cartilages.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be stressed and also not expose the second, third, or fifth patient on your list to a stressful situation or being under time pressure.
Yeah.
So surgeons should avoid time pressure, should take time, as we just heard in a couple of sessions, to infiltrate the nose and then go for a coffee break and come back after 10, 12 minutes, also guaranteeing a bloodless procedure or make the procedure as bloodless as possible. You nicely mentioned that holding a hand of a patient before surgery is also very important, reassuring the patient that you are there. Both of you should be in a calm state before surgery. Yeah. So this is so different from sinus surgery.
Yeah.
Sinus surgery is just all the cavities, actually trying to make sure nature does its work and the immune system gets to a normal state. Rhinoplasty is a much more challenging procedure, especially if we promise patients, or if we share with patients what is the goal of surgery.
Yeah.
We as a rhinoplasty patient share to share with our patients what is the expected outcome. I don't know any sinus surgeon who actually showed the patient the post-op CT scan and showed, this is how your sinuses will look like after surgery. So we put a lot of stress on our shoulders, and therefore I do think we should be very careful and should also take care of our own mental health.
So what are some tips for that? Like, to the listeners, what would you say to them? They need to kind of mentally prepare for surgery and have a way to tap out and relax?
Nicely summarized. So you also need to carefully select your patient, of course. And this is one of our focuses of research, thanks to the collaboration with Fidelio-Lekapis we had on the and to the research that we did together on rejection and why we reject patients for surgery.
Yes.
I think personality of patient is also crucial, and it should be considered before even thinking about techniques.
Yes.
Because the one and only crucial question that you should ask yourself before surgery is, will I be able to satisfy the patient?
Mm.
Then the second question is, will I be able to do the surgery? But the first question will be like, will I be able to turn this patient into a satisfied patient? And that is the crucial question. And that's actually the reason why within my patient population that I see, patients that are referred for surgery, of whom 2/3 are revision cases, that I tend to refuse to take them to the OR in 1/3 of the cases.
Really?
Because I think their personality is too complicated.
I would just interrupt you here. You're saying that 1/3 of the patients who end up with you, and like you're a lead in Belgium, so a lot of people are afraid, but you're not actually going to be operating on 1/3 of the patients. That's very interesting.
That reflects also the reality of our work.
Yeah.
55% of my patients have purely aesthetic problems nowadays.
Yeah.
And we did a study with Dr. Valerie Picavet one day on the prevalence of BDD symptoms. And within this aesthetic patient population that I see, BDD symptoms are prevalent in 42% of my patients. Not all of them have severe BDD, severe BDD symptoms. Not all have extreme BDD symptoms. But this is just a reality. And we do know that the severity of BDD symptoms before surgery correlates very well with the degree of dissatisfaction 1 year after surgery.
Mm.
This has all been published. This is all work that was even published, I think, by the New York Times 10 years ago.
Wow.
They cited us as the Belgian study showing that BDD symptoms are very prevalent in those seeking rhinoplasty for purely aesthetic reasons. And we associated the preoperative BDD symptom severity state with the outcomes after rhinoplasty. And there was a clear correlation, which is very obvious and which just reflects our common sense and gut feeling. But somebody should do the work and should do the studies to show.
So Peter, another question. You and I politely disagree on functional testing preoperatively. Maybe you want to chat a little bit about that, because I use full-phase rhinomanometry, and I use it because I can actually draw out a graph on the computer that can show me quite clearly the difference between the two different sides of the nose. Is it the gold standard? I don't think it's necessarily the gold standard, but it does help a lot with being able to show patients where the problem is and show those patients who are acting as if their nose is obstructed that it's not obstructed.
Well, I agree in 95% of opinions with you, so there is no...
That's good to disagree.
That's good. But I slightly disagree on the value of acoustic rhinometry or active anterior rhinomanometry.
Yes.
Where I do believe that the outcomes also depends on the person carrying out the test. Because depending on how you position the probe, you will have better or worse outcomes of your measurement.
Yes.
I tend to believe more in the peak nasal inspiratory flow measurements because the outcomes of this technique reflects more the subjective feeling of nasal obstruction. And nowadays, I tend to rely even most on the mirror test, which is very simple, which I always use to convince and show patients how badly or how well their nasal breathing is. And for me, this is also a tool to convince them that the breathing is not as bad as they think.
Yeah.
So I often use it to eliminate those who come to see me for fake functional problems, trying to get an aesthetic rhinoplasty reimbursed.
Wow.
Sure. So indeed, there is no optimal functional test for patients, but in the end, rhinomanometry is very good.
Yeah.
It's very helpful. We always apply it also for medical reasons and medical legal issues, but not so much for my diagnosis. But if you're a plastic surgeon or maxillofacial surgeon, you might like to have this data because you cannot properly evaluate the nose with a nasal endoscope.
Yeah.
Because we perform nasal endoscopy in all our patients because we want to rule out mucosal swelling. We want to rule out problems at the nasopharynx. We want to rule out problems even at the same nasal cavity at the level of the osteomedial complex.
Yeah.
So for us, nasal endoscopy is part of the diagnostic workup before rhinoplasty.
Yeah, sure.
So therefore, I don't perform Holmium scan or CT scan before before rhinoplasty because I do believe that with a nasal endoscope, I know what to do and what not to do and what region to avoid or what other problems to take care of.
But in a case where the septum is so severely deviated that you can't even get your endoscope in, would you consider then doing a CT scan?
That would make sense.
Yeah.
But okay, you look at the contralateral sites and if there are no problems, no polyp there, the mucosa is quiet, you know that there is no allergy, there is no sinus disease. Yeah. But anyhow, I think Enrico Robotti and some others during this course, including yourself, may have convinced me that I should consider more taking a CT scan before.
But a Cobenfy CT scan, not a conventional CT scan, which costs a lot less, gives a lot less radiation. And it's to me, like I can literally, within 30 seconds of asking for the CT scan, it's on my desk.
Yeah.
And our MaxFax colleagues have been doing Cobenfy CT scans for many years.
Mm.
So Peter, the last thing I really wanted to ask you about is, over the past 15 years of running this course, on the one side, like reflecting what some of the highlights have been, but also where do you see the future of rhinoplasty over the next decade or two in Europe?
That's a challenging question because there are so many different philosophies. There's so many different initiatives. Mm. And I just think that patients will be better informed about outcomes. Patients would like to understand better what is the likelihood of them being satisfied after surgery. And I think they have the right to know. And therefore, I do believe there will be some more pressure from patients asking about outcomes and functional as well as at aesthetic level, preventing them or preventing at least some from being operated. Also here during the course, we heard that with nasal valve surgery, we cannot solve all the nasal obstruction problems because in the end, some patients will never be happy with the nose, even with the nasal valve that is properly functioning. So we need to be very careful in our diagnostic workout and also in the preoperative counseling of our patients on what they can expect and cannot expect. Because some patients are just over-expecting.
And
we need to deal with that in a very proper way, in a very honest way.
Yeah.
And I do believe ethics is crucial in rhinoplasty. And you may have noticed that the faculty members of the European Rhinoplasty course all have the authentic feeling and authentic ambition to really learn, to transfer knowledge, and to educate in a very proper and very ethically sound way, which always renders me very happy and always renders me very proud of this course because we heard a lot about ethics and approaches towards patients and also a respectful attitude towards our patients. And I think that's crucial.
No, but Peter, I think the person who you are, that you're respectful towards the people you work with, that flows into the rhinoplasty course. And I think what I love about being able to come here and is there's this absolute obsession with wanting to teach. But teach honestly, you know, and I think that's what draws people here.
Yeah, we had a couple of lectures where suboptimal results have been shared where challenging cases and challenging videos have been shared, because life is never perfect. Life is never like in the nicest video that are sometimes being shown on stage.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's so good that people feel reassured that there may occur problems, that you need to look for solutions sometimes last minute during the surgery. And this is wonderful, because this reflects daily life, and this reflects the challenges even of those with 20, 30 or 40 years of experience.
Well, Peter, listen, from two thank yous. First, from us, I thank you for inviting me to be a director of the horses. Lovely. But then on behalf of the listeners from around the world, thank you for what you do for rhinoplasty in this planet. Just carry on teaching people, because that little, it's like this little drop that you put in a lake, and the ripples go out. So, I mean, you've got people from so many different countries around the world who come to Brussels to learn, and they've got cadaver dissection, they've got lectures, they've seen the videos, etc. And then from there, they go home and they work. So thank you.
No, thanks to you as well for all the efforts you make also in this podcast and for your very enthusiastic participation in European Rhinoplasty. Thank you so much.
Good. So guys, make sure you clock into next week's podcast episode. We're going to smoke the season. It's going to be fantastic. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.